is the House Judiciary Committee, March 1st, 1985, work session.
Order, please. We'll begin. The order will take the bills today. Will be House Bill 2261, and then 2336, 37, and then 58, 2258, and then going down the list from there. We had sort of a quick hearing on a couple of these bills, and so we may want to a little more time. God bless you. Spend a little more time. On some of these, House Bill 2261, we have Dale Penn and Chuck Foster and Norm Neal. We have some comments. If they'd like to come forward, please. We also have counsel memo from Linda Zuckerman from legal counsel for the Judicial Department. Is that for the record?
That's for the record.
Okay. And then we have proposed amendments from Anthony Taylor. If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dale Penn. I'm a Marion County District Attorney. I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association on House Bill 2261. There, at the initial hearing, is my understanding that there was some questions about the seizure of abandoned property and how much revenue source that was for counties. I have been able to develop some information about that, and I'd advise the subcommittee about that at this time. Benton County received approximately $2,000 a year on sales of abandoned property. And Lane County in the last 5 years has received $30 only in one sale. They have another sale that's going to take place in the future. However, they have received some monies from sale mainly of bicycles that are found and lost, approximately about $5,000 over that period of time. Lincoln County reports that they receive about $300 per year for the auctioning of seized property, abandoned property. In Marion County, in trying to determine that, Sheriff Foster is here, and he may be able to give you more precise information, but it's very difficult to determine that. It's his opinion that, based upon cost of storage and auctioneering and that type of thing, that it's basically a break-even proposition. Which brings us to the position of the ODAA on this bill, and that is that I think it's a very good purpose in what the legislation is proposing to do, to assist third parties that may be, that may suffer a loss. However, it's our observation in dealing in the system that this is dealing with a very isolated problem, and by creating a right under the law, I think that we will be creating a nightmare and a fiscal nightmare for the counties and the police agencies involved. It's important to note, first of all, that the present victims compensation program has no remedy whatsoever for victims of property damages. In this situation, this bill would allow basically a remedy for a third party person, not a victim, to be paid for expenses where they've suffered a property loss. We don't pay witnesses or victims for the time that they lose in coming down to testify, lost wages, all of that. There are lots of different things that are not repaid in the criminal system the way it is now. It certainly is our policy as district attorneys that in this situation we would ask for restitution and ask that that cost be assessed in a case, but the remedy goes back to the defendant. Will the defendant pay? And that appears to be the remedy in this bill, and that is not a remedy. it really is not a funding source. It creates a horrendous problem in creating this legal right. How do you judge the terms substantially sane condition, appropriate compensation? I think what you're going to do is create a right, and then we'll get involved basically in condemnation cases in trying to litigate what is substantially sane condition, what was the proper value, what is the appropriate amount of damages that should be paid by the investigative agency. I think that alone would create an administrative nightmare and fiscal nightmare for the counties. But the last point I want to make, and the main reason that we oppose this bill, we certainly agree that third parties who suffer a loss because of an investigation, if at all possible, each investigation I've ever been involved in, investigative agencies make efforts to repay for problems that come up or damages that are done. But in making a legal right, we will create a chilling effect on investigations. In searching for the truth, whether it be a murder investigation, a robbery, or rape, or whatever it is, the public policy is that you want to establish the truth. Who is guilty? What has happened? And if we start tying investigation to whoever has an open budget line, we get into real problems. I'll give you some personal examples that I have had. Towing of cars. I've had murder cases where perhaps the murder occurred in the vehicle. It becomes necessary, obviously, to tow that vehicle, to examine it, have the crime lab do an examination of that vehicle. And I've had to stand and argue with police agencies over whether or not that car will be towed because they tell me they don't have any money in their investigative line item to tow vehicles. And it basically comes down to, if I can scrounge up the money to pay for that tow, we'll have that car towed. If I can't, we won't. When we start creating legal rights, such as 2261, this is going to be a severe problem, because we're investigating a murder and we need to cut out a window where you have bullet holes or we have blood stains in the carpet and we have to take a section of that carpet. We're going to get involved in who has the money available, who can pay for this, rather than trying to determine who or what is the truth, who is the guilty party, what actually took place. I think that is a real substantial practical problem created by this legislation, and without a funding source identified and available, it will severely restrict in the future the capabilities to discover the truth.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bunn.
Wouldn't it, when you talk about the fiscal impact on the agency involved and the administrative cost, aren't we in effect saying that we'll continue to place that burden on the individual? We're presently saying we don't want the danger of the agency paying this cost. Isn't it more equitable to have either the agency or society as a whole pay that cost as opposed to an innocent third party?
Except that you're taking a system that is already severely strapped economically and fiscally. Every sheriff's office, if Sheriff Foster would come in here and tell you about his fiscal problems in Marion County, there is no money, there is no funding source available. We're not just talking about where is the fiscal burden going to lie. We're talking about creating really an administrative remedy here of lawsuits to determine what is substantial value and what is the substantially the same condition, what's the appropriate value to pay. What I'm saying is, I think that this bill comes because of one court of appeals case where the top of a car was taken to examine in a murder case, as I understand it. And the defendant evidently was driving this vehicle, and his parents sued to be repaid for the cost of taking this car apart. Now, that is one example of where a third party had to take responsibility for that cost. I don't think you can come up with a lot or many more examples like that, because in most situations, insurance will cover it. And very likely insurance may have covered that cost. I think you have to take into account that the defendant was related to the victims who were suing here, and there very possibly was some animosity against the state because that person, the son, who was the defendant, was convicted of a very serious crime. And that's a problem.
Real question.
Representative
Bum. Bill, you mentioned a concern about wording being used like just compensation in substantially the same condition. Throughout all of our statutes, there are things like reasonable, just, and constantly we're measuring in a perhaps a subjective way those issues, and we've geared state agencies, courts, attorneys, prosecutors to doing that kind of measuring. If they can do it in all these other areas, why can't they effectively do it here?
The observation I'm making is that this is not, this bill in two paragraphs here isn't just a very simple thing that the police and the third party person will sit down and say, well, we'll work this out, it's worth $100. Because the Court of Appeals case that I talked to, that I guess gave rise to this, is an example. This creates a legal right, and I think you're going to create a lot of litigation to try to determine, well, what was the value of this guitar that was purchased 10 years ago, but the third-party person is saying is an antique that can't be replaced and is worth $2,000. You get into all those kinds of problems that it appears on its face. It's very simple, just to sit down and you'll agree and then you pay the money, where in reality I think it would create a lot of litigation from this bill.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Sheriff Foster, welcome this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Chuck Foster, Sheriff of Marion County. I'm here speaking on my behalf on 2261, although I'm reasonably certain that most law enforcement would agree with some of my comments. Dale, obviously, is a prosecutor and very eloquent, and I agree with most of what he said, and specifically with the bottom line. I would ask that the committee re-examine the current victims' assistance legislation. It's my opinion in reading that would address the issue that is of concern, and it is an issue. Innocent victims ought not to be further penalized because they were in a position that some criminal damaged their property or law enforcement officer had to take some of their property. This carpet, for example, if a homicide was committed in here and an officer felt the compulsion to take a piece out of it for analysis, what is the damage? And obviously that carpet ought to be repaired. But to impose that liability upon the investigative agency, I think you will cause a chilling effect. And I can tell you for certain, in my office, investigative decisions would be based specifically around financial matters as opposed to the other more appropriate matters when you make a decision. And we would be in a position of making a decision not to follow through a proper method of investigating because we just simply don't have the money to stand the liability. I think another point that might be brought out, it would appear to me that if we can impose a requirement to have insurance in automobiles, perhaps it's possible to impose a liability upon insurance carriers to provide compensation for damage to property when it occurs during the course of a criminal investigation. I guess without repeating much of what Dale said to you, I would ask you, number one, to reevaluate the victim assistance legislation. I personally think it covers it, and ask you to consider increasing the assessment so that there would be a pool. And secondly, to think very carefully about supporting anything that's going to put a dampening on an otherwise proper investigation, for what it's worth.
Questions, Representative Bellamy?
what can we do to discourage overreaction by the law enforcement people?
I think the best thing you could do that is put confidence in police administration. And believe me, it's my opinion that most police administrators are interested in ensuring that there's not an overreaction, whether it's in this arena or in the other arena. I suppose the same kind of control could apply to the legislature. Frankly, I'd hate to see you overreact with a piece of legislation, but the control of that is the public and subsequent history.
Let me ask you this. What would you do if one of your officers, in the course of investigating a criminal deal, obviously went too far and destroyed property that he had no business destroying? What would you do yourself?
I've had that happen, and quite frankly, we paid for the repair. Now, it's easy to second guess after the fact and say, you shouldn't have destroyed that door jamb, or you shouldn't have, if you were trying to seek a bullet that's in a wall, why take the entire wall down when you could have just taken a square footage? And in those cases, I've made what I think is a reasonable, arbitrary, if you will, judgment that that's something that we went too far. Now, whether I went back and criticized the individual officer depended upon what he had in mind at the time that it occurred. I have verbally advised. I've never had a circumstance where officers acted with gross disregard to personal property. And I, quite frankly, don't think that happens very often.
One additional question. I suggested that the possible answer to this, and where you're here in Marion County, you would be able to use it better than anybody else. We allow, particularly in the case of an automobile, the labs at the state pen to work on an automobile if the owner agreed. I've also suggested that judges maybe could use the community service as part of their sentence. If you get some people that come in that are good, you can't really say law-abiding, but at one point they were, but they're good standing citizens. They just did some wrong things. Give them a community service assignment, and maybe the community service they would agree, a mutual agreement. Do you think there's any possibilities of those two things? And can it happen now?
Theoretically, that's a good concept. And I guess the quickest way for me to answer that is say that I can't even get one of those, quote, good citizens that's required to do community service to wash my patrol cars. Not because there isn't plenty of them around, but they can't be trusted not to put the water hose down the gas tank. And quite frankly, I'm not certain if my car was damaged and the sheriff came to me and said, hey, we're going to make you a deal. We're going to take this thing out and let the convicts fix it for you.
I wasn't thinking about police cars.
Well, no, okay. Your car, for example, I'm not certain I'd feel very comfortable if I said to tell you that you're going to get your car back within the next 30 days repaired.
No, Chuck, I didn't think that you would dare send one of your county police cars out there to be fixed.
No, I wasn't talking about one of my county cars. I've sent some of my county vehicles out, and they've done an excellent job. But it's taken 6 to 9 months to get that done. So, quite frankly, the approach, I like your approach. I don't think it'll work.
But you're saying here in Marion County, it just isn't going to, you probably are not going to use it where you folks would use it the most of anybody.
I would use it if it were reasonably available.
Counsel.
In response to Representative Gomez's concern last week, I called up the Oregon State Prison. Their garage is closed. It wasn't moneymaker.
Nice try. I don't know. Anybody want to watch you pick up anyway?
But I will tell you that it is a serious problem. We've had circumstances here where one of the folks that was on an early release decided to hold up a bank, and during the process he stole two different cars, and a couple of kidnapped a couple of people, damaged several cars during the subsequent escape attempt. My officers, during the exchange of gunfire, did extensive damage to the car, to the pickup. The owner of the pickup lost his tools during the charade. The pickup went through a backyard into a house and a couple of cars on the street. Now, there were several people that were victim beyond reason. And those folks should have some way of seeking redress. But if you were to impose that on the law enforcement entity, that person probably would not have been arrested.
Thank you. Mr. Neal? I see Tom Bessonette sitting out there anxiously waiting to respond to a question or two.
My name is Norman B. Neal, Sheriff of Douglas County, and I too oppose legislation as it is written now. This will hamper law enforcement very strongly. The cases that have come up that we know in the past that have the third victim has lost a great deal. Bartholomew's question regarding someone else to repair this, we've had some problems in this area of working our prisoners, the trustees, going out. Maybe the car had slid through the yard or something to repair the grass. And small instances, this might work. But when you get into a major project, it needs someone to supervise what is to be done. And there's just not manpower available to do that. The towing of vehicles, bullet holes in walls, the kicking of a door down, there's nothing a administrator hates to hear any worse than a door being removed into a living room and knocked on the floor. But it does happen because that's one of the first things that a criminal will do is try to slam the door in your face, letting you head for the back door or wherever, or to obtain a firearm. And naturally, the next response is the officer to take the door down. But we caution them to at least ways, if no one will answer the door and you hear activity, to try the doorknob before they kick the door down. And that may sound ridiculous, but you've got to remember when you're at this particular incident, this may be a murderer there, and feelings are running quite high, and you may overlook a slight thing, such as just simply turning the doorknob to go through the door instead of going through it. In Douglas County, if we remove a door through our investigation as a forcible thing, we feel that's pretty much our responsibility to replace that door, and we'll do that in most instances, and immediately contacting the landlord and letting him know what has taken place. But we found the landlords in a lot of instances also charge a fee before the person moves in to cover any damages to that property also, and we'll sit down and work with them and discuss this before we make a final settlement or whatever on it. But this, I feel, will restrict law enforcement and those small little details that makes a difference in a conviction and not in a conviction. We have a murder trial going on right now, which a large issue was made over a bullet. And I feel we went as far as we should go, other than actually starting digging the person's property up to hunt for that bullet. We skimmed the property right down to ground level, clear through the house. The house had burned. And I fear we used reasonable grounds and didn't go any further. And we didn't turn the bullet and we didn't go any further, but it was a severe thing. I would have liked to have dug down another foot around the foundations and so forth of the house, but we restrained from doing that, knowing that there would be serious effects to the foundation. But, and making it short, I oppose it, and I encourage you to do the same, because it will restrict those fine things in law enforcement that sometimes will make the difference between a conviction.
Sheriff Neal, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Do you have a regular policy, an office policy that you abide by, and could you give us some sort of indication of how often you have to this problem?
We've had, in my first term of office, I've had to replace probably 5 doors, and that's 4 years. And we've had a number of large drug raids, and you can hear them running inside the house, the toilets flushing, And it's not a written policy, but if they know it is my policy that when these type of things happen, you've got to move fast, and if that door is secured, then we're going in if we have search warrants and so forth. For
actually, I was thinking more of the policy and working with the landlords in terms of repaying.
No, that's only my personal feelings that we work with in the office while I'm sheriff.
And how often do you have to work with the landlords or property owners?
I don't recall any landlord other than if we can't find him right away, of him coming by and seeing the door tore off of his apartment, he's upset. But if we can get to them and make them aware, or even before we make the move on the house, they've been very cooperative.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Springer.
Sheriff, what's your annual budget down there in Douglas County?
My budget is $4.6 million. I have 5,089 square miles, fifth in the state.
Are you one of those counties where you've had some problems with your budget in terms of getting enough that you feel is necessary to do a good job down there?
Yes. And again this year, my budget now is the same size as it was 4 years ago. And that includes two raises that have been through.
Have you had to reduce your number of deputies?
Yes, I'm down to 32 road deputies now from 54.
Is this in part because the county hasn't been getting much money on its timber receipts?
The timber receipts are not up to what they normally are. But this does not interfere with what I previously told you. If we've done some damage intentionally and can work with the landlord, we're going to work with them.
I think you said there have probably been about five doors that you've had to replace. Were there any times where you didn't make a replacement? Because
not to my knowledge in my term of office.
What would be a cost on those doors? Maybe $100 each?
It depends upon whether the door jam and everything goes with it, or how much time he has to secure the door. If it has a long bolt, too, of course that goes on in, and you could get into $100, $150.
So that's taking the $150 times five, that's about $750 over 4 years?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Sheriff.
Thank you. Mr. Bessman, I just have one question for you. Always appreciate your stopping by this hearing and being a resource to us.
Yes, Tom Bessonette with Oregon Mutual Insurance Company.
Do you have any idea of property owners, how is it a regular basis that property owners put in a claim either for their damage to their auto or to a dwelling or damage done by police, sheriffs, law enforcement officers?
I can recall a couple of claims, and I say two or three probably, recently, and where homes have been damaged by a crime, not necessarily the sheriffs or the police. One was a murder situation where blood was splattered all over the house because of the type of death that occurred. That was covered by the insurance policy.
In your regular old automobile policy, if you are, the liability insurance should cover where if I'm eluding the police and I run into your car and then I keep on going, your insurance is going to take care of that damage.
Yes, as long as you're driving your own vehicle or not a stolen vehicle. If you're driving a stolen vehicle, of course, there is no insurance tracking with you at that time.
Okay. Does any of the committee members have any questions? Representative Bond.
Quick question. If there's insurance on an auto, but a person is driving it as a stolen auto, then there's no insurance coverage if there's damage.
What you just said? I can't hear what you're saying.
Well, that's because I didn't make my question clear.
No, because I couldn't hear your voice.
If there is an auto that has insurance coverage for the normal drivers, someone else steals that car, goes out and wrecks it, the normal owner cannot get it repaired, is that what you're saying?
No. The normal owner is not legally responsible for the damage caused by the thief while driving the car. However, if the car has physical damage insurance on it, then that coverage still applies.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Bellamy.
Basically, what you're telling us is that in the cases of the damage done, it's pretty well up to the owner of the property to carry the insurance. Criminal situation. The guy steals your car, takes it out, and runs into somebody's house. The homeowner better have had insurance himself in that case.
Yes. The insurance company, his own insurance company, would pay for the damages and then attempt to collect it back from the culprit. Thank you.
I hope this doesn't have a chilling effect in terms of your visiting us.
No, bills of interest, I always come in and listen.
Okay, we'll close the hearing on 2251, and we'll...
I think this type of law that we're discussing today would take that away from those people in Eastern Oregon. I haven't been there since 1978, but I did make a couple of phone calls this morning to some police chiefs that I know in that area, and I would encourage you, before you take any action, to contact some law enforcement officials in Ontario, Nyssa, Hermiston, and the sheriffs in those counties, and get their input.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Counsel?
Yeah, and Mr. Allen, how many police officers in the state and or in Eastern Oregon did you have that spoke Spanish?
I'm sorry?
How many officers, police officers, did you have that spoke Spanish?
When I left there, I had two Spanish-speaking officers that worked for me.
In your experience with working and cooperating with immigration, were most of the raids done on Hispanic or Mexican aliens?
Yes.
Were there any Canadians ever picked up?
There wasn't a, not that I'm aware of, there wasn't a large influx of Canadian people in that area.
Are you aware that approximately 15% of the illegal immigration in the Northwest is from Canada?
I'm not aware of that.
Thank you.
Mr. Allen, I just have a quick question. You're currently the police chief in Staten.
Yes.
Does INS draft you folks or ask you to help?
I've never had any contact with INS in the 7 years I've been in Staten.
Do you know if local, for example, I guess the Woodburn police chief,
yes,
is he, assuming it's a he, is he asked to
I believe they are. I believe they are, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. People here that wanted to comment on House Bill 2337.
Santos.
I'm sorry.
Santos.
Oh, Mr. Santos.
My name is Danny Santos, president of the Hispanic Local Action Committee, currently a law student at Miami University.
Rebecca Crocker, chairperson of the Mid-Willamette Valley HPAC, Hispanic Political Action Committee in Salem.
I'd just like to start out with some comments from our past testimony we had last Wednesday, or last Tuesday, and some updating of where we are. Primarily, I want to start out from a viewpoint that the Hispanic Political Action Committee does not impose the enforcement of federal immigration law. That is an object of the federal law. We see that and support that. I think the Hispanic community has as much to gain by the enforcement of that law as any other community at large. What we're simply asking for is that law be administered and enforced properly by the officials that are designated by law to enforce such a policy. I think today you, by your testimony before you, have seen the example we cited to you last time where there is some confusion among law enforcement agencies as to what role they play in the enforcement of federal immigration law and to what extent they can actually go. I think it's been very unfortunate to see that you see some selective enforcement of the law here and that they're willing to enforce the law. They see an individual or they proceed to see populations that they suspect to be illegally here and then simply are not willing to enforce the law at that time or play a role at that time, or quite willing to get involved at a later stage when INS either requests or when they come to the assistance of INS. Once again, I think there's a matter of training in immigration law, and I think there's also a question as to liability. I think, once again, we'll go back and cite the court cases regarding, you know, the liability of local, county, and state law enforcement agencies in these cases, so that not only are we talking about the expenditure of equipment and personnel time, but also subjecting the local resources to liability for failure or for improper enforcement of federal immigration law. I think we also want to go back and distinguish the point that, or bring up the point that INS Deputy Counsel, in the concurrence with the viewpoint that we've expressed at the last session, 1983, when this bill was initially brought before the legislature. The other thing, too, I'd like to do is distinguish, again, the aspect of we recognize that the law enforcement agents here are sworn to uphold the law. And once again, we're just wishing to distinguish between criminal law and civil law, the violations there. And once again, bring to you the examples of tax law and other landlord-tenant law, a variety of other aspects that are not enforced by local law enforcement agencies. I think one thing that's being overlooked here is the concern for the Hispanic citizen. And also, I think once we're just going beyond and saying, well, we're obviously dealing with an isolated situation of totally illegally undocumented workers or populations within this country. The unfortunate truth is that is not what's happening. We are having American citizens put to this test with the assistance, unfortunately, at times, with local law enforcement agencies. It is something that goes against the Hispanic community's desires to have such local resources and time and equipment go to this end. With that, I'll just let Rebecca talk.
Well, I listened to the Marion County Sheriff and the Douglas County Sheriff give their testimony, and I feel that some of their concerns were well taken, and Danny kind of went over the reasons why we're here, and I think that's important because we're here on the behalf of the Hispanic people and some of the laws that they're trying to enforce just because we are brown and not because of the fact that they even know we're suspected of being illegal aliens. So I think that's what we're trying to address. It's not INS versus local sheriff departments and what they're trying to do. We just want to put it in this right perspective. Marion County Sheriff said that INS seldom comes to Marion County Sheriff Department for assistance. If that is so, then why does the Marion County Sheriff Department feel that it's important for them to do their job? The Douglas County Sheriff said, referring to the problem of the federal government, stated that minorities have priority on bids. Does this statement mean that only minority contractors are using illegal aliens in doing their tree farming? Another point of the situation is the Forest Department puts out a lot of contracts. They have a minimum amount of their contracts that go out to minority people. And so is that stating that all minority contractors that go out and get these bids in the Forest Department are using illegal aliens, which I know is not true. So I think that the cases that they're bringing up is not substantiated by what we're trying to do. It's not the fact that If they are illegal, then I think that INS should take care of that, and it should not be Marion or Douglas County that is concerned with that. They should be using their funds to take care of the local problems that they have and do it more adequately, and then giving INS their responsibility. If they need more funds, then they should go to Congress to do that.
Questions from the committee, Representative Bellamy?
Do you have a copy of the bill in front of you?
Yes.
On line 5, I would like for you to just, you don't have to comment now, but when we go into work session, are we going into work session on this bill?
I think we'll hold this over till Tuesday.
Okay. But I would probably propose to put the word direct in front of the word purpose about halfway through the line. I'd like for your comments on that. Briefly, my thoughts are this. Douglas County is a good example. If they casually needed to use their radio equipment, I personally don't believe they should be using Douglas County's vehicles and this sort of thing. If they casually needed on occasion to use the radio equipment, when I use the word direct, We're still sending a direct signal from the state of Oregon, in my opinion, to the law enforcement agencies that you're not to be using your stuff for INS purposes. So I'd like for you to think about that, see if that, in your opinion, totally ruins the whole concept of what you're trying to get at the work session. You don't need to comment on it now. It's one you need to think about.
And I would add, by Tuesday, if you could think about an amendment, although I'm not decided whether I'd propose this amendment, but on line 5, to delete the words monies, equipment, or.
Are we going to leave personnel in there?
Yes, personnel would be in there, for sure.
There would be.
In other words, it would be a prohibition against use of personnel, but as Representative Bellamy is getting after, if there's an emergency situation where some of the communication network may be needed, and they go through that. But again, it's just for food for thought at this point.
Along those lines, I think we'd be glad to comment on that at work session, but there's also been stipulations of consent degrees and force. There's been stipulations for consent degrees for Forest Grove Police Department exactly prohibiting equipment, monies, personnel from use assisting INS in those matters. Once again, we go back to court cases, and I think once again you're going to have a liability issue when the extent of your involvement, whether it be personnel, be it equipment, be it monies, will bring you back into the deep pockets, I think, in there. And so I think you need to be concerned about that.
Okay. No further comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the hearing on 2337.
Let's see. I can't imagine going back home and telling somebody that.
Of course, the Emory case is an interesting case when you hear the other side.
You think he went through a radio?
Yeah, they're.
Oh, yeah, well, the fact the guy was.
We lose it.
But what if it was a finance company? The guy stuck with a lien.
Let's go to House Bill 2258. We have some proposed amendments. I'm not sure where these came from. Yes. Twenty two
2258 was Justice of the Peace Bill. And in front of you should have some amendments.
Who is the sponsor of the amendments?
These are the bills provided for by Nita Bellows and Kathy Martin. They're both judges from Eastern Oregon. You will notice that on the second page of the amendments, there was a notation from Bob Lundy. He had a problem with one of the suggested amendments. Ms. Judge Bellows had suggested charging a $15 fee for a request to Civil Division. He didn't understand what that meant. And we just got the minutes at 1:30, so I'll have to double check with that.
Okay, if he could contact, I guess, the judges and see if what their intent was on this.
Do these amendments are they the same thing as these Hand and Gross?
Correct. They're the same. Then I sent these Hand and Gross amendments to Legislative Council, and Mr. Lundy had a couple concerns. Chairman, would you like me to go over some of those concerns at this time?
Sure.
Okay. One was, first concern was, in a justice court, there is no responsive pleading by defendant. The defendant merely shows up for hearing. There is no real answer filed. In terms of the amendments, there was a request of a $5 fee for defendant filing an answer. So there's no answer. So Mr. Lundy wrote it in terms of a physical appearance. When a defendant physically appears in a case, he or she will be charged $5. That's the best he could do. I mentioned the fact about the transfer to Civil Division. He didn't understand what that meant. Mr. Lundy was also under the opinion that Justices of the Peace could not enforce foreign judgments, that foreign judgments were covered by the Uniform Foreign Judgment Act, and it probably would have to be enforced by a circuit court, that justice courses had limited jurisdictions.
I think we better do some investigation of that, because I think Judge Bellows would tell you that she's doing foreign judgments all the time, and if counsel says they can't do it, we better check into that, because if they can't do it, I'm sure she'd like to know that.
That's right.
Was aware. I told him that.
Okay. Can we get a written opinion from counsel on that topic, please?
Okay. The last concern was on the fees. Going to the Hand and Gross version, he asked what the difference between D and F were on page 1.
Wait a minute, page 1.
Lines 12 and 14. He asked what the difference was between a transcript of a judgment and a certified copy of a judgment. And I didn't know the answer.
And I understand that. You know, you just received these and would need to contact one of the JP judges. And, okay, did he have other concerns?
That was basically the concerns.
Also, I don't see any representatives from the counties here. I would hope that you could... I assume with these amendments and close to what we're coming, except for the concerns with from Legislative Council, which have to be resolved. But essentially, this is the bill as the Justices of Peace would like to have. And I would like some sort of, I assume we don't have a fiscal impact statement yet.
Correct.
And I'd like to see.
I suggest that you don't get one.
Well, what I'm saying is I'd like to have one. And I don't know how we go about doing it, because I'm really kind of, you know, same with our other courts. These figures don't mean anything to me, except that out there in the hinterlands, people, my prison in West Salem, or actually in Salem, would be paying substantial amount more money for first appearance, for example, and I don't see a justification yet. I mean, I know that there's been inflation out there in the real world, and I know that generally costs have been going up, but and I do appreciate the fact we had a very abbreviated hearing last Friday on this topic, but I need something more than some citizens coming in saying double these fees. And if council could work with the Association of Counties to see, for example, if they want to take three or four counties, a Valley County and an Eastern Oregon County and a coastal county, and show where the money goes, why there's a need, and what kind of budgetary controls there are over these budgets vis-a-vis the county commissions. Because if we are raising the fees for the justice, these courts, I want to make certain that the monies are going to the justice courts and aren't going to the counties to build parking lots, for example.
The only thing I would say is that it doesn't affect municipal courts. So the first thing you're going to find is there's very few urban county or western Oregon counties that this would affect.
I think we have one up the canyon in Marion County, actually.
Justice Court?
Yeah.
Yeah. I just want to say that probably this is one of the reasons why we had the court takeover, so that the state could get a hold of the information, but we should try. I think one of the things that Justice has told me is that it has been so long since their fees have ever been increased. Maybe we could ask also to take four or five of these and that are comparable in the district court and give us a comparison of what your filing is in district court versus justice court. Because essentially they're the same thing.
I'd like to
do all of them, Rocky, but you know, give me five or six of them that you can compare with.
Counsel.
Okay, one of the concerns with Judges Bellows and Martin, and also with legislative counsel, is that these laws affecting justice of the peace and municipal courts are really scattered throughout the ORS, and they're really not comprehensive and kind of uniform. And Bob Lundy's personal preference is he would like to rewrite the whole section on municipal courts and justice of the peace.
Would he have time to do that this session?
We do have that one bill dealing with appeals from justice courts, but I don't think so.
Yeah, it might be appropriate for an interim.
Correct.
Study. Okay. I'm not asking that you do numbers crunching on this.
Okay, thanks.
I'm asking that you delegate this.
Thanks.
Maybe we should specifically ask, maybe we should also ask one of the counties to bring in one of the county judges or county commissioners to talk about the budget. It's one thing for the justice of the peace judges to talk about the budget, but your aspect is, you know, what are we talking about in terms of the county budget?
Right. Okay.
Maybe that'd be a good thing to try to get the counties to bring us in somebody that deals with the total budget.
Mm-hmm.
I have a note here that indicated that they wanted to raise their limit to $5,000 on section 51.080. Do we have any thoughts on that? What's the $5,000?
I believe their concern was that we have now, through the bill you carried yesterday, House Bill 297, have increased the jurisdiction of district courts, and there should be a corresponding change with justice courts. Otherwise, there's a wide range between circuit court and justice courts.
What's their limit now? Does anybody know?
25.
For justice court.
Was it 2500?
I think 2500.
Well, I can look at that too.
It's 2,500 according to my notes, and I think it's 51,080. It's either 51 or 55 over here. Do you have a bill that's coming in on the jurisdictional note?
Well, I don't know. We introduced those two bills, but I don't know if they deal with jurisdictional.
No.
Boy.
Well, I was going to take a recess at this point. If we're finished with 2258 for today.
Do you see it? No.
What's that?
The limit.
Oh, I think you pulled the wrong views of the annotation.
Check. Oh. You're right.
I was going to take a break.
Yeah.
Why don't we take a recess? You object?
No, just
5 minutes.
Five.
As a we get to take testimony with three people.
Sure, yeah, we use one. Yeah.
Okay. Are there any other comments on 2258 at this point? I think we've given a lot of direction to counsel in terms of information we need, and so with
anything
that.
Anything to assist counsel.
Now.
Oops.
On the public hospital 2336, we have some amendments.
All I've got to say is that is there anybody here from the AG's office on this bill? I have requested, and the AG is working. We have the counties, and I have the AG, and I have a district attorney looking at eliminating the whole chapter 415. We're asking whether what would happen if we did. Is there a problem with the exception of 415.120? I think there's some, and we have some amendments to 415.120 that I think are probably, which essentially says that the public bodies have to furnish INS with information if INS requests it. And I don't really see anything wrong with that. The district attorney also said that in my county, and I'm going to get back to him on Monday, that he wanted it particularly in light of 2337, he wanted it particularly put into law that stated that nothing should prevent a district attorney or a law enforcement, probably just a district attorney, to contact the INS when they have arrested a person for a criminal charge that has nothing to do with being an illegal alien. Arrested a person for a criminal charge. Nothing would prevent the police agents or the district attorney from calling INS in to check the illegal alien status. Particularly, he said that thought it was very interesting. He said, when I first came into office, Mike Sullivan of Jefferson County, very strong DA in Jefferson County, he said, when I first came into office, every time an illegal or a person was brought into my office and I suspected them of being illegals, I immediately called INS. So what I did was immediately create a group of people out there that could be victims of crime and absolutely have no recourse. And he says, now my policy is exactly the opposite. The only time I call INS is when I have one that I want to get rid of. They're a troublemaker, and he says, I call in INS, and I drop the charges, and we send them back home. And he wanted to make sure that if we eliminated Chapter 415, that we included that provision that said that once the individual was arrested for a crime,
then if the agency wanted to, they could call INS in for assistance. Other than that, we haven't got it ready for work session. Everybody's busy kind of looking at it. But my suggestion is that I'm not so sure that any of Section 415 is necessary, except possibly 0.120, which is the last subsection.
I agree, and I think we will try to finish up work on this on Tuesday. Council,
well, I think they should be ready by then.
Okay. Now, in looking at these amendments, would these amendments address the situation that Representative Bellamy is talking about in terms?
Anita Paulson and Mr. Santos worked on these amendments, and we were trying to get to capture the tenor of what the committee was suggesting last time. I don't think they go as far as Representative Bellamy, and I'm sure Mr. Santos is here and could speak to that. I think he would be in full agreement with Representative Bellamy.
Okay. Mr. Santos?
My name is Danny Santos, president of the statewide Hispanic Local Action Committee, testifying on 2336 in favor of it. As legal counsel has indicated to you, we took time since our last testimony on this bill, took the direction of the committee, and simply tried to focus on the issue of public health agencies and those types of agencies, public agencies. The only comment I would have right now in response to Representative Bellamy's situation is, I think one of the things we were trying to do was take away the affirmative duty of the agencies to report. And though the district attorney's office and my center would be able to exercise an option, I think that's a gray area that'd be kind of hard to outline as to when it's the option, when it's optional and when it's the exercise. But I think it primarily does focus in on what we would find to get accomplished too. So.
In looking at this, the amendments still repeal 415.1.